Hello, DNCers, and this week's episode is brought to you by Vettery and Blue Medora. Let me tell you about Vettery first. They're an online hiring marketplace, and they're trying to change the way that people hire and get hired. Once you go on there, you can make a profile, and companies will reach out to you and request interviews. It's really stress-free and really easy way to find the dream job that you've always wanted. Once you get on their marketplace, top employers review your profile and extend you any review requests via email, and you can set preferences for your things like your desired location, what your top skills are, how much experience you have, your background, your salary requirements, so on and so forth. So you'll only get matched with the jobs that you really want. They partner with over 20,000 companies from innovative startups to big Fortune 500 firms, and they're all across the US, Canada, and the UK. Now, Vettery is free to join, and if you sign up at vettery.com/doesnotcompute, you'll get a $300 bonus if you accept a job offer through Vettery. That is awesome. It helps you, and it also goes to help the show. So check them out, vettery.com/doesnotcompute.
All right, so we got sort of a special episode today. We're on location in Orlando, and we're here with our new friend of the show, Mr. Nick Molnar.
You got it. Nailed it.
Who is the principal program manager of VS Visual Studio Online at Microsoft.
We're actually on the floor in the hub, which is like the expo area of MS Ignite. We're in this booth that is like has plexiglass walls and the ceiling's open. We have headsets on.
It's a fish tank, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
And we're just surrounded. We're immersed in Microsoft.
We're the beautiful zoo animals that everybody came to see.
Please don't feed us.
It looks to me like most people are just staring at the LED screens that are positioned around the room, which seems to be normal, right? That's like normal human behavior.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just go towards the light.
Just go towards the light.
I mean, there was a guy, while we were waiting for the booth, we just watched a guy, most excited person I've ever seen about pivot tables.
Oh.
Like, pivot tables are cool.
I saw that. He's got a crowd.
Yeah, and pivot tables are cool, but like...
He pulled us in. Like, we started way farther away from his booth than we, you know, and I don't know, I've opened Excel twice in my life, and maybe in high school, so he had me going. I wanted him to speak at my graduation, whatever graduation I might have. I don't know. He was a national treasure, just really excited about data. I need more people like that in my life.
I can't remember her name. She's a doctor. It starts with an F, like Feline or something is her name. She does this talk about Excel and about it's all that I know about functional programming is from this, and she argues that Excel is a functional programming language.
Oh shoot.
And it completely shifted the way that I think about functional programming, because I'm like, oh wait a minute, no, that is how you would do it functionally, is like copying it from cell to cell effectively. And she does some amazing thing, like she like draws graphics and stuff like that with little Excel cells. Anyway, go YouTube that.
You're speaking our language
so,
now.
So what you're saying is it's just functions.
It's just functions. And so there's a reason why you guys got excited about pivot tables.
I wonder how you do tail call optimization with an Excel table. Anyway.
Yeah.
So we're talking about VS Code Online today, which has been in private beta since I think early this year, right?
Yeah, since May at the Build conference that Microsoft had, we announced it there.
Okay, now it's actually publicly available as a preview for everyone.
Right, yeah, public beta, if you will.
Okay.
Yep, exactly.
And so we heard about this at the keynote Monday morning, and we're like, okay, we need to like play with this a little bit and check it out. Now, Sean and I, Sean, his stack is on Heroku. I'm on AWS. He's technically on AWS, right? We don't have Azure accounts, right? So we're like, okay, we got to see what this VS Code thing online is all about. And we're both familiar with the editor VS Code.
Sure. Right?
So we, in between sessions, we go out in the hallway. Sean's got his MacBook Pro. I didn't bring it. I just have my iPad. We both made Azure accounts, get the free credit. All right.
I love where this is going already.
I hope.
Yeah, yeah.
Bring it home for me, Rockwell.
We pointed at the repo for the website for the podcast, which is a Vue.js. It's a Gridsome application.
It's based on Gridsome, yeah.
Gridsome.
Yeah.
So we pointed at that. It detected NPM and installed our dependencies. We loaded the environment variables in it, and we had the site running.
Nice.
Now, it gets better. So Sean is on his MacBook Pro. I'm running Visual Studio Code on my iPad in the browser, which says it's not supported. It works fine. And Sean does a live code share session with me. I start making changes. I hit save, I push to master, and the site's live.
That's awesome.
We did that in like less than an hour. We figured that out.
Yeah, it was maybe 15 minutes. So the only thing that I got hung up on was I forgot to copy my environment variables into the into the new session or the new what's it called, the container, basically.
Right.
So yeah, so I had VS Code connected remotely to my Azure stack, and he was connected to me via LiveShare, pushing production code to my app through my computer.
Netlify, right?
Yeah, it was weird.
That's awesome. Yeah, the internet is amazing that these things can all come together and work. I've been doing web development for like 23 years or something like that now, right? And it's the little things, right? The detail, like you all get it. It's the details that really matter. Like,
yeah,
when you press F5, it doesn't refresh the tab.
Right.
It launches the debugger, and you're like, oh, okay, that's crazy.
Yeah, and even on the crappy internet here at the convention center,
so
we're trying, even like tethered to the phone, it's bad. It worked enough for us to get it working, you know?
I think technically yesterday we were tethering off of my phone.
Yeah, the whole time. It's great.
So this is a true story. On Sunday, I was practicing my demo with my director, right? So she's my boss, like three levels up.
No pressure.
She's on the plane flying from Seattle to here. The Wi-Fi was so bad on Sunday here that I was on my phone as a hotspot. And that was the only time that we had to practice our demo.
Right.
And it worked. She was 10,000 feet in the air and I was on a hotspot. And we pushed code together and co-edited and co-debugged.
Well, we did something similar a few weeks ago because Rockwell is contracting on a project for my company right now. And you were in an airplane.
Yeah.
And we were just kind of rubber ducking some code. And you're like, let me see it. So I sent him a live share link and he's on an airplane fixing my stuff, basically, you know?
Yeah.
Which was pretty cool for me as, so like part of my focus as a CTO is like, I'm juggling so many things. There's just things I need not to have to worry about. Right. And so for me, it's a huge asset to be able to, with a copy of a link, you know, have someone available to double check my work if I'm working on something that's critical, like have someone be an additional pair of eyes, right? For me, that's hugely important just because I get tired, you know, I'm the only person looking at it, only person shipping code. So I get tired, I make mistakes, I tend to rush stuff, you know? So
sure,
the ability to have Rockwell looking at my stuff, and he didn't even have anything cloned. He didn't have to install my version of Elixir. He didn't have to compile my version of Erlang, which would have taken who knows long on an airplane. He was just in my app running, working, and it was super useful.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, so, I mean, we told you earlier, like, we're excited. This might sound like an ad, but we're genuinely excited about this because I've got a junior developer that works with me, and he saves me a lot of just time. I'm able to assign him stuff that I could do, but because he's around, I'm able to spend my time on more expensive things, basically.
Sure.
And so I got him set up, and he had just an older laptop. And so, you know, it wasn't running the best on his laptop. So we went over to his PC, his desktop PC, and we got WSL set up. He was having a few issues here and there. So for him, he wasn't really able to be productive, you know? And so when we were watching the keynote for this, I was like, this, like you said, it's the little things, right? Like if it just works, then I don't have to, if I don't get cut a thousand times setting it up.
Yeah.
For me, this is worth it because I can say, hey, Drew, install this plugin and you have everything running. Like he doesn't need to know about Elixir or anything because he doesn't work on that side of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So I can just say, here's an environment that's set up for you. Plug in and work on it. Oh, by the way, if you're out and about, you don't have to be glued to your desktop. You can work when you need to, when you feel productive, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It helps with the onboarding. And hearing the feedback from a lot of people, they're thinking of Visual Studio Online is like, oh, this could potentially replace my laptop.
Right.
I'd actually say that it's not the right way of thinking about it. Like it's more project and task oriented, right? It replaces lots of things. Have five of them up in the cloud, right? One for Elixir, one for some Ruby project, one for a quick PR review that you're doing, right? They spin up so fast and they're disposable. You just throw them away like a paper towel and you get a new one when you have another mess to clean up, right?
Yeah.
And because of the isolation between them, you're not really worried, right? So your junior guy can get up and running quickly. You can hire on new people or you can go work on some exotic, like I'm not a Rust guy, right? But I'm interested in it.
Sure.
And sometimes I'm like, I got my machine perfect. Or I really want to go and install Rust. I don't know what that's going to mess up. And who cares? I can go like spin it up in this temporary little space that I throw away.
Yeah, so when he started actually working on stuff, we got together and I was helping him get his machine set up, you know, so I had a README to follow and all that stuff. And it ended up messing with his version of Elixir because we were using different Elixir version managers,
yeah,
different version of Postgres, you know, so then he had to start worrying about, okay, well, is this going to break my existing setup for my job?
Exactly. You know? Yeah, exactly.
So it's just sort of a pain. Yeah. So I've looked at doing this a couple of times. I think it was maybe 2016. A coworker of mine, Paul, tried an experiment where we both just got a DO. We set up a DigitalOcean instance, and we just SSH'd in with Vim. But we were just killed by latency. It was really, we'd be in a flow state, and then suddenly things would slow down, and it would just kill productivity. So again, we were trying it yesterday off of my phone in a crowded, what is this, conference center?
Sure.
And it worked pretty okay. Like it was mostly fine.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've been stress testing it, and I've been working late nights leading up to the launch, right, and getting ready for it. And so I spent an entire day working out of our Southeast Asia data center.
Okay.
Just to see, and I live in Texas, right, to make that clear for everybody, just to see, like, what did that latency feel like? And it felt really good. Like, it was slightly noticeable, right? But I literally passed three other data centers, and we have a limited number of data centers right now for preview. But it's really amazing the way that the technology works and how we just pass around the context that you need to do things like get autocompletes and to do a build and debug and things like that. So a lot of the other remoting solutions that are out there have to send over so much more information over the wire that bandwidth and latency really, really are seen more quickly than with what we have right now.
So you mentioned the thinking of the workspaces as sort of disposable.
Yeah.
And you have, in order to make them disposable, you have to also be able to set them up quickly. Tearing down is easy, you just delete.
Sure.
But setting it up, there's a lot of sort of work that goes into building up the state of your development environment, right? I mean, you know, how many times do we have readmes of install this, right?
Right.
For our own local box. And so what does that look like in terms of, like, setting environment variables, SSH keys, for example, like, you know, all this sort of secrets that you need, and then also seeding databases, right? Any kind of other state or information that you need, like how is that approached?
Yeah, so there's kind of three options, and you can mix and match them a little bit, right? So everything kind of follows like this GitOps model where the repository that you're trying to work off of is the center of gravity. That's where you're going to place your configuration by default. So let's say you walk up to some random repo that has not been configured at all, right? Which is all of them, but like five,
right?
Yeah, five Microsoft ones and my sample apps. What we do in that case is we have smart defaults that will, like as you all saw, right? We kind of analyze your code base. We saw that, you know, you had a package.json. We do the NPM install. We made sure that you got Node LTS on the box. We do all of that kind of stuff, right? So that's kind of option number one. You might call that the most magical one or kind of smart default. The next step up is you can put into your Git repository a dev container file, right, which is literally just a JSON file. And that JSON file can specify declaratively a few different settings, like if you have certain ports that you want to be automatically forwarded, you can just list them, we'll forward them. If you want to install certain VS Code extensions, we'll install them for you, right? So you can have the Go extension installed or the Elixir extension, whatever you need. There's a few other bits and bobs. One of the properties that's in that file is called post create command. And this allows you to run whatever command that you want to on the machine once we're ready provisioning on it. So you could run a bash script. You can apt-get something. It's your box. Do whatever you want to with it and install up. And then the third option, which we actually have hidden behind an experimental flag right now, but it's documented, so you can go try it, is you can point to a Docker image or a Docker file, and we will build that, and that will be the container that you sit on top of. So for some of the things that you were talking about, scripting, the things that show up in the README, right, you can use a Docker file and a little bit of, you know, scripting magic or something else. Now, so the way that we kind of think about these environments that are getting provisioned is that they are customizable. And so everything that I just talked about, I put into the customizable bucket. And all of those changes, if I made it to repository A, the whole team working on repository A we'll have the exact same experience, right? Everybody would get that Docker file with the versions of things specified. It'll be just like that.
Yeah, that's great.
Which is great because it eliminates like, oh, well, it works on my machine. Like, what's wrong with your machine? Oh, you have the wrong version of Elixir. I'm going to break my other project now. Like, you get rid of those things. That's the customizable bucket. Then there's the personalizable bucket. These are the things that are for you, right? Let's add on my opinion on top of it. So I have my bash RC file. I have the aliases that I like. I have the theme that I like for VS Code. I have the fonts that I want to use, like all of the things that make it feel like the way I want it to feel. And so we can, you can also point to a secondary repository optionally. We call it the .files repository, where all of that stuff lives.
Okay.
And it also has a post create install command. And so you can run things there. So what we don't have today that you specifically brought up, and so and just in full transparency, given that we launched preview yesterday, is we don't have a really great experience, I don't think, around secrets management. So what I do in all of my apps right now is I use my .files repository, which is private, to list out different ENV files.
Okay.
And then I just kind of, I set them up to be the environment variables when the thing launches. Because those are private to me. It's still secret because it's in a private GitHub repo. But, you know, in the coming months, we're going to make sure that we have real secret support.
Okay. That was one of the questions I posed to Sean. Is like, would you feel, because I thought of that too, using the dot files, and I was like, would you feel, they're both like, no, it feels weird putting secrets in a...
It's a workaround right
like,
now.
Yeah. But again, you said if it's private, and it's probably fine, and especially if it's only development environment, who cares? But
yeah.
Okay.
Well, it depends on what your secret is. So yeah. I used to work for government contracting. So yeah, you could get fired for some
that
of those kinds
fly.
Of things.
That wouldn't fly.
Yeah.
So the Docker stuff is really interesting to me because I'm pretty mobile when I work. So I work from home, but I get cabin fever a lot. So I'll go to coffee shops, or there's a beach by where I live that has Wi-Fi. So I go there sometimes.
Nice.
And other places, like I might go, have to travel, and I might have a shoddy Wi-Fi, right? So one of the things I was thinking about is like, let's say that my team is on VS Code and we have things set up with Docker. So I have, in our specific app, we have some dependencies, like we have Postgres, we have Elasticsearch, and then we sort of have a private dependency. It's like a little, our only microservice that we have, a little PHP thing that kind of hangs out. And so my Docker container pulls that from a GitHub repo and sets that up.
Okay.
So I guess like what I was thinking about initially is like, okay, so say that I'm working, my daily workflow is like, you know, I'm just using VS Code online and be able to travel around. I have Wi-Fi. It's great, but I'm going to go on a trip. I need to somehow pull down my setup. And if we're just using Docker, then we're good. You know,
it's,
I can just prepare ahead of time. I can pull it down and work locally.
So, and just to make sure I'm clear, like you want to basically be offline for a while, get some work done.
I want to have it
both
ways.
Continue in the environment. Yeah, yeah. You want to have Visual Studio offline.
Yeah.
So that would be coming at build 2020. No, I'm just joking. that is a scenario that has come up a couple of times. We actually have some folks on our team who have tried to kind of like hack around with how do we take the Docker file that we create in that first option I gave, right, where we do some of the more automatic settings to kind of like extract that out and then run that locally. It's something that we're looking into, and we should continue to have the conversation offline about what that would look like. The big question is, well, like, how does state syncing work when you're done? You know, I could see some kind of like a check-in, check-out type thing where you check out your environment, and at that point, we'll have to do something to prep it, and then when you check it back in, we'll have to unpack all of that. But, you know, when we start talking about what state means, like if it's just stuff in the Git repo, that's pretty easy because I can just ask you to do a push,
right?
But there's other stuff that lives on the box that might not be in Git, right? Like if you installed something extra on the box or whatever your process state is, those are kinds of things that we need to think through.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
We did see something about self-hosted environments. Can you explain a little more about that? Because I didn't really understand how that works.
Yeah, not a problem. So our kind of the default model that we work is that we have cloud-hosted environments that we create for you. This is a great solution because it's augmenting your compute. You both commented that you're kind of running around with these small computers, right? And effectively, you now have infinite power of the cloud. You can just keep on adding more and more and more on. And it's crazy, right? Because like, you get rid of noisy neighbor problems. Like I know for my machine, right? I'm in this big corporate enterprise, right? There's like IT lockdown and antiviruses and all of these kinds of things that sometimes get in my way as a developer.
Right.
I no longer have that kind of contention because I've taken the heavy dev workload and I've moved it to somewhere else. And now I can do more email and I can do more streaming, right? My local environment frees up. So all of that is kind of managed service, and you pay for that as you consume it, right? As is typically expected these days for SaaS offerings. The self-hosted, it brings a lot of the same benefits, but it's you give us the compute that you want us to run the environment on. So this is particularly helpful. Like maybe you already have a developer environment that's perfectly tuned in just the way that you want it, and you don't want to go through the whole rigmarole of setting up your Docker file and all of that and kind of codifying that, right? So you can run a command on that box, and it will be made available. Command is called register. You register that box with our service, and now if you go to online.visualstudio.com, that box is there for you to connect to.
Okay.
And then it looks and feels like any other box with very similar features, but it's on you to keep that thing running, right? If it shuts down, the power goes out, we're not going to keep it running for you, right? And but when it's up, you can connect to it from the browser and do what you want to do with it.
And I imagine people interested in like need to keep that stuff on premise for whatever reason, I imagine that's important for them too.
Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of, you know, questions about how do we do it on premise, and that is an option. It's also free, so it's a great way if you want to try out the service, you can go ahead and use the self-hosted. Or if you have specialized hardware, you know, like if there's something with a special GPU or something like that that you want that we don't offer in the cloud right now, then you can go use that.
I mean, that was probably one of the biggest questions I saw on Twitter anyway.
Yeah.
When I went looking was, hey, I'm an educator. I don't want to pay for it.
Yeah.
Or can't pay for it, you know, or whatever.
Right.
I'm fine. I'm happy to pay for it. But I guess I'm in a different situation than some other people. But
sure. Well, you also mentioned like the two of you yesterday used your free Azure credits.
Right.
So it is called Visual Studio Online. But in terms of like billing, it is actually an Azure service. So you can go to azure.microsoft.com/account/free, and you can get your $200 free, and you can use it on any Azure service, including Visual Studio Online. So that's something that the educators could look at. It's not a long-term solution, obviously. Or then, of course, they can use the self-hosted.
Yeah, yeah. So I did have some other, like, not necessarily specifically like service-oriented questions, but like talking to, I want to say his name right again, Arjun, right?
Arjun.
Yeah, shout out to Arjun. He was awesome. We just got talking tech yesterday about it. And so he was telling me about a plugin he made for VS Code. I think it was a chat window inside VS Code.
Yeah, live share chat he did.
And he was using Elixir. So what was even funnier was the first person I talked to at this conference happened to be familiar with Elixir. It blew my mind.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask about
It's not your daddy's Microsoft anymore.
No, it's not. It's weird. I actually tweeted this morning after Scott's Hanselman's keynote. I was like, Microsoft has me on the ropes right now because I've been having some. So I have this shiny MacBook Pro and my keys are sticking all the time. And it's like I spent money on it because I was hoping it would last me a few years. And it probably will, but it might not. And that might not is what keeps me up at night.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So. Got me on the ropes right now.
Got you on the ropes from a Visual Studio Online perspective, or even from a hardware perspective.
Hardware perspective too.
Yeah, the Surface devices are nice.
Yeah, and especially like battery too. I carry around a 15-inch MacBook Pro. It's heavy. Battery doesn't last super long. So because of that, I have a solar panel and an external battery that puts out enough watts to charge. It has to put out at least 87 watts to charge my MacBook Pro.
Okay. Yeah.
So I have a giant backpack, you know, and I'm hauling around town on this thing. And I can only imagine what people think. I don't carry the solar panel around all the time.
You just get a special hat to wear it around. So you're always charging. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I should get a wagon and hitch it to my... Or I'll make my dog... I just got a dog, Watson. I'll make him pull the wagon around, maybe.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so even thinking about that, I mean, if I'm not tied to... I don't have to have super powerful hardware to build my stuff. If I can just take my iPad to a coffee shop, maybe I'm able to focus there better.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Is this a solar panel? I'm looking at a
picture
right now.
Yeah, I'm showing a picture. He's at the park. And he's got outside. He's got a solar panel and this gigantic battery
that
pack.
That thing is huge. It looks like the size of a car battery.
87 watts. It's got to put out. So it puts out up to 150 watts out of the plug on the side.
Yeah. I think you're a glutton for punishment.
It's good for my cardio. It's good exercise.
Looks like it's good for your weightlifting too. It's an arm day or leg day.
Exactly. It's like training for jujitsu. It's like someone on my back as I walk.
It's like a kettlebell. You're like doing CrossFit with your computer.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break from the floor at MS Ignite to tell you about Blue Medora. Blue Medora has set the standard for enterprise-grade integration for IT monitoring. They seamlessly stream metrics and logs from all kinds of different sources right into your favorite monitoring platform. Of course, you already have IT monitoring with all the different stacks and applications and traces and all that stuff, but all those data sets can be siloed off from each other. You've got different dashboards, different permissions, different accounts. What a mess. Blue Medora's solution to all this is called Bindplane. It'll take in your metrics and logs from over 150 different technologies. And that can be on-premise, hybrid cloud, or multi-cloud, which, if I'm being honest, I didn't know a lot about before this week at MS Ignite. Anyway, it takes all those different sources and feeds them right into your favorite monitoring tool. Things like Google Stackdriver, New Relic, Azure Monitor, something called Wavefront, and of course, Datadog. You can see how the different components of your stack are interacting in real time and draw relationships between all the metrics previously that you couldn't have done quite so easily. You get a single pane of glass view, just a single dashboard that shows the performance of your entire stack, and you don't have to waste time configuring agents or developing custom integrations, all that stuff. It adds a real dimensionality to your metrics, allowing you to dig down and pinpoint performance issues faster than ever before. Now, it's free to install the Google Stackdriver plugin with Bloomadora, but if you head on over to bloomadora.com/compute and do that, you'll get a $200 credit towards Google Cloud Platform, which can even be combined with Google's existing free trial credits. Bloomadora.com/compute. Turn your information into insight with Bloomadora.
But I did want to talk about just some more like technical stuff behind it. Like,
yeah,
I'm sure there are tons of problems that you guys had to solve, you know. And I'm sort of interested in like the technology that powers it. Obviously, I am itching to find out if Microsoft uses Elixir. But
I guarantee you we do. I don't know if there's any Elixir in this project.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, what's especially interesting was seeing Scott's keynote this morning, and I haven't played with WSL at all. Sean has a little bit, right? And seeing how VS Code sort of, there's a server and a client component to it, from what I can gather,
sure,
and
yeah,
that's how when you're running code, quote unquote, natively on Windows, it communicates with the Unix or Linux subsystem,
right?
Just basically over TCP or whatever, right? Just a socket. So I can imagine like that's sort of the foundation on which the service seems to be built on.
Yeah. So the real foundation to unwind to is actually ships as a product. A set of extensions for Visual Studio Code called Visual Studio Code Remote Development. And so this is a set of extensions there's three of them. There's one for connecting to a remote development environment over SSH. There's one for connecting to Docker containers. And there's one for connecting to WSL, the Windows subsystem for Linux,
okay,
and executing your environment in there. So the VS Code team shipped that in April, I want to say. Right? And so it kind of enables very common patterns, right? The developers who are SSHing into machines and then using Vim or Emacs or something like that to do their development work, right? It's kind of giving them the power of Visual Studio Code to do something very similar.
Yeah.
And so that is the technology that a lot of the connectivity that you were asking about between the client and the server, at least if you're using VS Code, works. If you're using Visual Studio IDE, it uses a different set of technologies. But what's in public preview today uses that. The Visual Studio on IDE stuff is in private preview. So that's kind of really the technical and philosophical foundations of the product. And then we kind of expanded on both of those, both technically and philosophically.
Right.
Right. So like, then we add in the manage layer. Because one of the problems that customers who use the remote extensions come back and say is like, oh, this is really great that I can do this, but now I have to manage that box, right? It's self-hosting, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I have to configure SSH. Some users have no problem doing it. Some of them, you know, have some more technical challenges, right? So we basically provision a way to automate all of that, plus all of the additional benefits of Visual Studio Online, right? All of the automation around your environment and keeping that in sync and letting you suspend it and billing and live share and all that
stuff. That for me is what makes me open my wallet, essentially.
Right.
It's time.
Exactly.
At the end of the day, it's time,
exactly,
and headache. And so if I'm not having to think about, something happened to my DO, drop it for whatever reason, I don't think about it.
Yeah.
And I can get back to answering support requests or helping my developers work or working on the roadmap or whatever, however many tasks I have to do, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because as we started understanding how all the pieces fit together, a little light bulb goes off, like, wait, we could do this ourselves today.
Yes, you totally could.
You can, but then it's like, but why?
we literally, internally, we talk about three scenarios. There's the DIY scenario, that's go take those remote extensions that we made available, they are free, and go do that. And we would encourage you to do that if you're of that mind, right? That's DIY. The BYO is the cloud hosted, right? Like, we make this easy. You can bring your own compute, just set up a computer. You don't have to worry about firewalls. You don't have to worry about that networking layer. We basically have removed that, and you can just register the environment. That's what we chatted about a moment ago. And then all the way to fully managed, right, where you get all of the benefits that we've discussed there for fully managed. You can connect to it from the browser and do it anywhere.
So what was the biggest technical challenge that you all had to solve for this?
You know, they come in and fits and waves. And there's not just one team that works on Visual Studio Online. This is a collaboration between our services team, the Visual Studio Code team, an additional team that just takes the web build of Visual Studio Code and puts it in the browser. And also to be clear, right, I'm a program manager, which means that while I am technical and I spent 20 years as a developer, I'm not shipping production code. Some of my code is in the product, but you know, for the most part, it's not. So my perspective on the biggest challenge will, you know, will probably be different than other folks that you talk to on the team.
Sure.
So saying all that, let me think, because I want to make sure I give you a good answer.
I was thinking about that too, because like you said, multiple teams having to make one cohesive thing would be would have to be difficult.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And like when I was looking at the product, it's like, okay, well, you know, there's even like you're building a UI, like the Azure, the, I forget what it's called again, like the spaces or like the container
workspaces.
Yeah, workspaces. Like you're designing something for developers, which are insanely nitpicky, insanely demanding, have really, really strong preferences in how they want stuff to work.
Yeah. So from a product perspective, right? Like if we talk about what's the most difficult thing from a product design perspective, that actually has been pretty easy, right? Because all the PMs on the team have been developers their whole lives, right? In our division, I work in developer division. Our customers are developers. All of us started as developers. And so we know all of those kind of finicky areas. And developers are also not shy to tell you those things.
Right.
Right. So like we kind of knew we had to have containers available so you can customize things. We knew that we couldn't force you to use a particular look and feel of the editor. From a technical perspective, I would say the thing that has been the biggest challenge is we have this user promise that these things are fast to create.
Okay.
And so you've seen the demos. You create an environment in about 30 seconds.
It's stupid fast.
Right. So think about that. Like, where do you go and get a VM, period, in 30 seconds? That doesn't happen, let alone the fact that we're putting a container on there for you. We're cloning your code in there for you. We're bringing in your .dot files. We're doing all of the other configuration and connecting you to it.
Right.
So there's certainly been a bunch of engineering effort to make that a magical experience that I'm very proud of what the team has done. But I've also seen some of the stuff to come.
Right.
And I can't wait to see that too, you know. So
I mean, it was like when we set up the Gritsum site, we got into it. Viter plugin was installed.
Prettier JS was installed.
Like it all just worked as I would have expected it to have on my actual computer, even though it wasn't on my actual computer, which was.
And when we started the server, and it said listening on port localhost colon 8080, the fact that it parsed that out of the console and just forwarded the port for us.
Oh yeah, there's a little notification that popped up and was like, oh, by the way, and I'm now listening. I'm like, hey,
that
thanks.
Was magical.
And then so when we switched from the hotel Wi-Fi to my phone, it automatically just popped up, said reconnecting me to the service, and we were just good to go, you know.
It was really
nice, you know.
In some ways, you know, the biggest competitor to Visual Studio Online or products like that is not another product, right, in our space, which you can go and look up some of the things that are similar to Visual Studio Online. The biggest competitor is the laptop that you have sitting in front of you.
Right.
Right. And so we are asking users in some ways to make a behavior change in order to unlock a whole world of possibilities and benefits. But we know that change is hard. And so there's been a lot of emphasis put on making it feel like it's local.
Yeah.
You guys pushed code, right? You weren't asked for your Git credentials because we just proxy your Git identity with you, right? So that's exactly how it would work if it was local.
Oh, I didn't even realize that. I think when we cloned it, we had to use the HTTPS URL and we couldn't push, so we ended up putting our...
I had to just change the remote to the...
Oh, okay. You had to change the remote.
And it was fine.
But we use the Git credential manager that's on your machine if you have it. If you don't, we'll prompt you, right? Yeah. But if you already have it, great, then we'll use those credentials.
Well, I did set up another environment for my personal project, and all those repos are private, but it just said please auth and said create an auth or auth and create.
Yeah.
So I did that. It switched me over to GitHub. I hit auth and then it just cloned it right down.
Yep.
That was it. Yeah.
Yep.
I think what you said really nailed it, or like summed it up for me, is like it's a behavioral change, and it sort of, I still feel sort of uneasy thinking about, can I do this like full, can I go this route full time? Because there's some comforting fact on having absolute control over the machine that's sitting in front of me, you know?
Sure.
Like if I want to throw it off a bridge, I can, you know?
Yeah. I'll make it even easier for you. All you have to do is hit the delete key.
Yeah. But But yeah, like you said, but it's a behavioral change to open up possibilities. It's behavioral change now to open up, like, have benefits later,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So like one thing Rocco and I were talking about earlier was we're just sort of daydreaming, like, okay, well, if essentially we're building these throwaway environments, right? So say he and I are both working on like greenfield features for my app, and we're both making database migration changes. So as of right now, if I need to jump over and help him out, I have to remember to roll back and, or, you know, export the DB as it was, yeah, or do whatever, do cleanup, roll back, check out his stuff, migrate. If I'm coming back, I have to roll back, come back, re-import my database, migrate, you know.
Yeah, context switching is really hard.
Yeah, context switching, yeah. So if I'm able to just like, okay, well, let me help you out, and then just create a new workspace. I keep forgetting the term. I'm picturing the UI, but like if I just...
Environment.
I just create a new environment and, oh, we fixed a bug. Let me just delete this thing and then check out the other one I was on.
Exactly.
And it's running exactly how it was.
Yep. Yeah, all the time. Like somebody will be like, hey, can you review this PR? And I'm like, I don't even have that language installed on my machine, yeah, right? Because we do cross-language stuff all the time. Great. Spin up an environment. Or yeah, do a quick little feature or experiment something. Do something maybe exotic for fun on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
That's what you do on the weekend. Yeah. You know, like, oh, there we go. Let me go get that elixir. That's going to be my exotic.
Light a candle, write some ASP.NET.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're pushing the elixir bug into Microsoft.
Yeah, so exactly. Yeah. Perfect.
No, it's been a really good experience. I'm really impressed with how things went. Like this is I wrote a blog post, which is huge because I've been saying I was going to start a blog for 100 episodes, something like that. I don't know. But I wrote a post and I was so when they originally reached out to us to come here, we weren't sure if we would, because I was like, you know, I'm not a Microsoft customer, and I guess I've been converted, right? So that's part of the goal. But really, like, I wasn't sure, like, what benefit am I going to get out of this? I'm not a customer. I'm not an enterprise company. I'm not all this stuff. And something that Scott said today, and I don't know if I'm drinking the Kool-Aid, but he was like, Microsoft is like, it's like a developer ally, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what it felt like. Some of the stuff he was showing this morning, I was like, oh, well, this is cool. And it alleviates my concerns about this machine on my desk where, like, my keyboard might break. I might be without my primary working machine for a week. You know, last year, Paul's computer, like, his keyboard just stopped working. Like, it wasn't that it wouldn't register a few keys. The whole thing just stopped working, period. So they had to replace the entire top of the case. And so he's like, hey, I'm going to have to use my wife's ancient laptop for a while until I get mine back. I don't know when that's going to be. So I might be a little slow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And for a two-engineer startup, that's huge.
That's huge, yeah. That's huge. You just lost half your company however long.
Exactly. So I'm crying, you know, reassigning issues to myself and all this stuff. But
yeah.
I don't know. It feels good. Like I feel, I don't know, I just feel good about everything happening, which is nice.
Yeah, I mean, the transition has been coming for a while, right? I'm coming up on 5 years at Microsoft now, but I mean, even if you kind of look at like the Wall Street reporting that comes out for Microsoft, it used to be Microsoft was the Windows company, right? We made billions and billions and billions of dollars on Windows. Now, if you look, we still make billions of dollars on Windows, but it's about a third of the company's revenue, right? The other third are services like Office 365 and Azure, right? So I think in past regimes of leadership at Microsoft, kind of the whole strategy was on, let's get everybody on Windows, right? So that meant get the users on Windows, get the developers on Windows, use Windows-based tooling, use Windows-based languages, right? When .NET was a Windows-only thing.
Yeah.
But that's not the engine of revenue. It is still an engine of revenue, but it's not the one anymore. Now we have Azure and we have Office services, right? Office 365. Do whatever you want to. Run Elixir on Azure, and we want to make Azure the best place to do that. Use whatever tools you want to, right? Go do some pivot tables out loud. Yeah,
I might go find that guy.
You should
have lunch with him. Yeah, he'll teach me how to do business, because I don't know how to do that.
We were just thinking, what if we fed all our log files into Excel, and then you could just pivot off of like timestamps or service? Yeah. Like you know, you could actually do that.
What would he say? He said he was like, some people have data down to the second. I don't understand why they have that or why they need that. And I was like, well, let me tell you, my friend.
Can we get microsecond?
Yeah,
yeah.
He is not thinking as a developer.
Yeah. No, it's been great so far. I enjoyed your presentation, and I'm enjoying what you guys are working on. The team really, like, this was awesome. Like, I walked into the VS Code space, and it was like the team just came over, said, hey, introduced themselves. Rockwell and I were trying to poke holes and stuff, and Arjun was just slapping his back. You know, like, here's an answer to your problem. Yeah. Or like, oh, yeah, I thought about that. Or he would, like, finish the sentence for us, you know?
Yeah.
It just, I don't know, it felt great. Like, everyone was just happy.
Yeah, we have a really great team. I actually came back to – I was on a sister team in the division. I left. I came back when I saw the group of folks that were getting assembled and the amazingness that it would be to bring, like, you know, a real web-based code editor out. The people are great. Jonathan, Allison, Mark, Katie, Felicia – man, if I forgot one of them, I'm going to get in so much trouble.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about, or maybe you can't, but just kind of stuff to look forward to with new features or improvements? We got some, I won't say anything because we got some nuggets, so I just want to know.
I don't think there's too many secrets, right? Like, we have been very transparent. That's another thing that I think you have probably seen being here, that Microsoft is not the secretive company, so... Literally in our documentation, it says, hey, here's a list of known issues.
Right, yeah.
Here's a list of enhancements that we're already working on, and all of that stuff is on GitHub, and we're asking for feedback, right? So
We saw right after the launch, we saw about a dozen issues coming on GitHub.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had 25 issues that I put into the issue tracker before we even launched.
Right.
Just because we knew that there were some, you know, rough edges or things that we wanted to do. So, for example, you got that banner saying that Safari is not supported. That's because there are corner cases where it's not. We're going to fix that. So Safari support coming, Firefox support is coming. I already mentioned that the Docker file support is under an experimental flag right now because we're trying to get things into people's hands as soon as we can, right, but responsibly. And so you can imagine that feature flag will go and we'll have full Docker file support. And then, you know, obviously we're getting a ton of feedback. We've had a private preview and we had users giving us a bunch of feedback. It's a whole nother level of feedback. So we'll take a couple of weeks to sift through it and continue to kind of make changes and updates as we go from there. But yeah, I mean, browser support, I think we're going to stabilize the service to make sure that even more extensions work. I keep on hearing bugs about, oh, this extension, that corner case doesn't work, or this one here doesn't. I'm amazed at how many do work. There was somebody on Twitter who installed 61 extensions. That was how they tried environments. I'm like, how's this going to work? And they all worked. So that was great. But there are corner cases. Our port forwarding setup right now, we know, isn't as robust as it could be. Right now, it supports HTTP and HTTPS traffic, but we would love to enable other protocols, you know, TCP, UDP, WebSockets, things like that. You know, there's a whole world of developers out there for us to go and light up. So
yeah,
we're very much right now focused on kind of cloud native developers who are writing services and web apps. And I think that we have a pretty good story to tell there, but that won't be where the story ends.
Yeah, because that was one thing one of the projects that I worked on is a Electron app.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, that's not really not going to fly for this. It doesn't really make sense.
Right. Yeah, we should talk about that. Because I do know that one of the things that is specifically enabled is you can build a Visual Studio Code extension. Visual Studio Code is an Electron app.
Sure.
In VS Online. And that all works.
Hmm.
I need to talk to the team about that. But it seems like we're a hop, skip, and a jump away from maybe enabling something with Electron.
Or in theory, I mean, Electron might even have a remote mode where I just run the Electron frame and it just connects to my box remotely, something like that. I don't actually know, but
yeah,
I can imagine something like that working pretty well.
I mean, that's kind of how like the Vue.js remote, because there's an Electron app for the Vue.js dev tools that you can have connect to other services.
Mm.
Sounds similar to that, but
that's cool. We're looking forward to kind of pushing it to its limits and seeing you know where it breaks.
Please do.
I'm really interested. I've tried to go this route a few times. I think because of the promise, like you said, of removing it's increased accessibility, right? Of allowing people to come in, allowing freelancers to come in, allowing new engineers to come in and be able to work on what they need to work on without having to bring the full stack.
Right.
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 So that's really compelling to me. And like I said, I've tried a couple of different services. I've tried to do it myself, but if it's managed for me, I'm happy. I pay for Heroku, right? So you obviously, you know, that's why I pay for it, because yeah, I could do that stuff myself, but I don't want to.
Yeah. And I mean, we're very sensitive too, right? Like, of course we're a company and we want to make money, right? That's no surprise, right? But we also want to make the service so valuable that you want to pay us money, as you've said, Sean, right? So we made sure that we are down to the second billing, right? If you use it for 30 seconds and shut it off, you're going to get billed for 30 seconds, right?
Yeah.
And then the other thing that we do, which you know, when we, I was just talking to a very large enterprise in the energy space who's here and came by the booth, and they're very interested, right? And so they tried to set up their own kind of remote development system for their developers, and they shut it down because of all these runaway costs where the developer would walk away and leave some VM running somewhere, right? So we were like, okay, we can't have that. So we have auto shutdown. If you go idle, you can pick a policy. Yeah. You want 5 minutes, 2 hours, never, but we will suspend your machine for you. You don't lose state, but you basically go into a no bill mode or a very nominal bill mode. That's fractions of a penny an hour that you end up paying. So.
And I think that was a big revelation for me, was like, you don't lose state. Yeah. Like, suspend is not delete. Suspend is like you're putting your laptop to sleep, essentially.
Exactly.
You're renting a virtual laptop.
Exactly.
Essentially is how it's happening. Yep. You can do with it what you need to. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to see what I can do about all the Docker stuff, because I have everything Dockerized now except for Elixir. So I developed natively on my laptop, but all the services are Dockerized, including our little microservice, the PHP little microservice.
Yeah.
So if I can just like move that over, I feel like I'd be happy, and I'll be like, yo, Drew, we got a solution, you know?
Yeah.
And that, again, is more peace of mind for me. So
yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. That'd be great. Definitely try it. And you know how to reach out to us on Twitter. I'm Nick, NIKMD23, or, you know, hashtag VS online. We'll get you going, or check out the repo.
I mean, that's a perfect segue. So you already, you know, you said your Twitter username. I'll put all that stuff in the show notes, like your contact information. Not your personal, of course, but,
yeah.
You know,
my address is...
You can mail him packages. So we'll put all that stuff in there. Is there anything you want to shout out? Like anybody, any projects, any stuff you're excited about?
My whole life right now is Visual Studio Online, right? So obviously Visual Studio Online, I want to shout out to the team, to all the developers back in Redmond and around the world who kind of burned some midnight oil to make launch happen, obviously.
Right.
I would send all the listeners over to online.visualstudio.com. They can sign up, jump in, and start playing around with the service, like you all mentioned. Things that I'm excited about, you know, I'm just, you know, I honestly was just excited to use the project. And I know that sounds like a cop out because I'm the PM of the project, right? But I, for my session that I did here, I wrote the demo app that you guys saw, that ballpark tracker.
Yeah, yeah.
I did that entire thing in the browser. Like, I had nothing. I went to my browser and I built that whole thing. And as a web developer, as I told you, web developer of 20 some years, it was just so cool. Like just geeking out, swapping between just, you know, the dev tools in the browser and then code running in the browser. Yeah, that was pretty slick. So
even thinking about, like I said, accessibility, you know, thinking about kids that don't have access to high powered machines, they can go to a library and sign in.
Yeah.
And make something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
To me, that's really cool.
I am kind of interested too to start to try to do some stuff that I wouldn't normally be able to do on my laptop, like big data, right? Or I need a terabyte of storage. I don't have that on my laptop,
right?
But I have it on Visual Studio Online because I have the full power of Azure, right? Or if I need to get, you know, some giant machine with 64 cores or something like that, like that's just not something I've done. So I've been partnering with a bunch of different teams around Azure who are all also excited about Visual Studio Online. In particular, two that come to mind that I just can't wait to play with is the IoT team, and they have a bunch of stuff that we're trying to figure out where it makes sense to collaborate. And Quantum, right? And we announced yesterday that we have Quantum hardware available now in Azure. But even before that, there's these emulators. And I'm like, yeah, I know there's Schrodinger's cat, and that's about the extent of my knowledge in Quantum. But they have Visual Studio Online enabled their environments. So there's... now just a link that you can click and you're a Quantum developer. So like, I feel like the possibility of what could be is what has me geeking out
right now. Yeah, definitely.
At least in the tech space. I also geek out about a bunch of other things that are not tech, but yeah.
what's one of those things?
Oh man, cooking. I do a lot of like really kind of technical cooking and baseball.
Baseball?
Oh, okay.
So the baseball season just ended, but I spent a bunch of time this summer building a replica of the manual scoreboard at Fenway Field.
Oh.
So I have a 7-foot by 5-foot large manual scoreboard. I had to pull down all of this open source data. I looked at the history of every baseball game played since 1880 and built up a histogram of how many zeros have been in a game, how many ones, twos, threes, so I could build out the right number of kind of little plaques that you put up there. So I just geek out about all these kind of random things
Wait, so what's the scale of that compared to the actual?
That is a good question. I don't actually know how big the actual one is, but it's basically the largest thing I could stick in my office.
I love it. Yeah. So you manually, you go in and change the numbers by hand?
Yeah, that's all. I have magnets, and every day I go and update the scoreboard for the Yankees. Yeah, which unfortunately,
they didn't make it to the end. You're putting the Yankee scores on the Fenway board?
Well, yeah.
Is that allowed?
Yeah, so I changed the name. It doesn't say Fenway Field. It says Mudville Field.
Oh, okay.
But it was still modeled after a very classic thing. Yeah,
I love it. That's very cool.
Well, if anyone has any feedback, questions, comments, concerns, maybe, I don't know, you should definitely reach out to us. We appreciate any shares or any ratings on iTunes. They help us out a lot. But really, we just love to talk to people that listen to the show and have questions. So, you know, get at us. We're open for business.
Yeah, same here.
Well, it's been great having you, Nick. It's we're really excited, and it sounds like you're excited too. So, yeah, this has been great.
Awesome. Thank you guys for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right, see ya.
As always, we'll post the show notes for this week's episode at dnc.show. We'll also post them over on spectrum.chat, where you can have real-time discussion with us about the show. You can always reach us on Twitter at dnccast. It is not DNC Show, like I've been saying for the past 12 months. DNC Cast on Twitter is where you'll find us. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I am Shrockwell. Thank you to Mikhail Delport for editing and Sarah Jackson for producing this week's episode. And of course, thank you so much to Nick for being on. Thanks again to Vettery for sponsoring this week's episode. You can set up your free profile and get interviews from over 20,000 companies to find that perfect job. Sign up at vettery.com/doesnotcompute and you'll get a $300 bonus if you accept a job through Vettery. And of course, thanks again to Blue Medora. Turn your flat metrics into deep dimensional analysis with the industry's leading monitoring integration as a service, or MIAS for short. Go to bluemedora.com/compute and you'll get a $200 credit towards Google Cloud Platform for taking advantage of Blue Medora's integration with Google Stackdriver.